welcome to Radio Gorgeous. This is the author of the week. This week we have Dana Chapnick over from New York with her book, The Falconer. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such an honor and a treat.
We are going to start with a short reading from The Falconer to start us off.
And I'm just going to drop you into the very, very beginning. The ball is a face, leathered and weathered and pockmarked and laugh-lined. No, it's not a face. It's a big round world with crevices and ravines slithering across tectonic plates. I bounce the world hard on the blacktop and it comes back into my hand covered with a fine layer of New York City diamond dust. Pavement shards, glass, crystallized exhaust from the West Side Highway, and it feels like a man's stubble, or what I imagine stubble might feel like, against my palm, and it's a face again. I bounce the face and it's back in my hand, and it's something else. A sun, a red terrestrial planet, an equidimensional spheroid made of cowhide and filled with nitrogen and oxygen. Whatever it is, whatever I imagine it to be, I know it holds some kind of magical power.
That introduces us to Lucy Adler.
Yes.
17 years old. Tell us more about Lucy.
So The Falconer is all told from the perspective of Lucy Adler, as you say, 17 years old. She is coming of age in New York in the early 1990s, and she is an incredible basketball player. And she is most alive and most in control of herself on the basketball court. Off the court, she is in unrequited love with her best friend and sometime pickup teammate, Percy, who is an heir to a very wealthy, prominent New York family who is skeptical of his own family's wealth or their means of acquiring their wealth. And she is also very close with a few other characters, most notably two radical feminist artists. Her older cousin Violet is one, and Violet's roommate and friend Max, short for Maxine. And she also has one other friend named Alexis, who comes from a very different neighborhood and a very different background, who she plays basketball with at her school. So that's sort of her basic world. And throughout the course of the novel, we watch her figure out who she is, not just in terms of a relationship with all of these people, but also who she is in terms of how her mind and her philosophy and the way that she views the world develops.
You see, for me, she inhabits my New York. I was graduated in 1989 and moved right back to the city. And this was my world. I think for British readers, you can read the pickup basketball game as the pickup football game in the park, the five-a-side.
Totally.
And that is a cross-cultural, very specifically New York kind of experience. She is white. Percy is, I mean, his last name could be Privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that is their entree.
Right.
That basketball allows her to cross many borders.
Yes.
And it is the only place where she is emboldened and empowered.
Right.
Talk to me about that role for you, for her, because I know you have been a sports journalist mm-hmm. as well.
Well, first I want to say that I was not the kind of basketball player that Lucy was. I did play basketball, but I consider myself a solid mediocre basketball player, and I'm not exaggerating, solid mediocre. But I didn't think that would be fun to write a novel about a not particularly great basketball player. So my background is in sports. I worked as a sports journalist, and then I eventually switched to the dark side and worked in sports marketing and PR. And it was the most fun, amazing time of my life. I loved every instance of it. But it was also a very interesting, and this is the kind of brain I have, I can sort of disassociate myself from what I'm doing and sort of be able to observe the culture that I'm in. And it was very interesting being a young woman in that field. And there were several jobs that I had that I was usually the only woman in the room. And because of that, it gave me sort of interesting insight into the male world and the way that women move within that space. And there are a number of reasons why I wanted to write about a young female athlete, but one of the main ones was I wanted to, it's a perfect metaphor, I think, for a woman navigating and succeeding in a world built for men, traditionally built for men. And in particular, at that point of time, that point in time in the early 1990s in the United States was a critical time for female athletes because Lucy's generation was the first generation to be born into Title IX, which I should probably explain for British viewers, British listeners. It was landmark legislation that essentially stated that any government funding that a school, whether it was university or public schools, any funding that they got from the government, they had to have equal funding for men and women, for boys and girls. And a lot of that came into play in sports, because before Title IX, there would be hundreds of student athletes at colleges that were getting, and thousands that were getting college scholarships, and very few for women. But after Title IX, they had to give the same amount of sports scholarship dollars to women as they were to men. And so therefore, there had to be parity among the sports teams. And so there was a massive groundswell in the United States to make sure that they were really funding youth women's sports. And so so Lucy is the first generation of girls to have come up where there was attention being put into, there was money and attention being paid to girls' athletics, but it wasn't at the point yet where it was so widespread as it is now. And there was still, and there was no professional league for women. The WNBA didn't exist yet. Nobody really paid attention to women's pro soccer the way they are now. We had a handful of female athletes that everybody looked up to. Most of them were figure skaters or gymnasts. And beyond that, there were, or Olympians. I mean, there were a lot of Olympians that were famous. But beyond that, there were very, you know, there was no Serena Williams. There were very few female athletes that had sort of like captured the American imagination. And so she was sort of growing up in that in-between phase. So I'm sort of rambling a bit, but that's sort of the genesis of why I wanted to write about that, because there's so much critical stuff that's going on in that time, in not just athletically, but in terms of the way that women have moved through the world.
I would say that is very interesting to me, because you just reminded me, I remember my mother helping the woman who turned out to be my field hockey coach, but helping her get Title IX money mm-hmm. to start a softball team.
Right.
Where there was no funding. For years, there was no funding. Then Title IX comes through, and finally, if they were going to fund, you know, boys baseball, then the softball had to be funded as well.
That's right.
And that was palpable. To me, that's very palpable, because that you set this novel in this time. Because I think about the Me Too generation or the movement, and it was us. It was me at that age in my early 20s. That was every room you walked into.
Oh,
and
for
that
sure.
was every room you navigated
yes.
in that way.
Yeah.
I don't know how it is for women now, because I'm not that young woman
right.
anymore with this knowledge that we carry now.
Right.
But that's how we navigated. And that whole, you know, sort of Judge Kavanaugh thing coming up, that was how the assumptions that were made when you moved through a room were prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we forget that.
I think
we forget how new and fledgling sexual parity and equality really is.
I completely agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I'm interested. So it's funny that the novel has in some ways been sort of categorized in some places as sort of being like a feminist Catcher in the Rye or something mm-hmm. like that. And I'm comfortable with that to an extent. But I always say that my novel is in conversation with feminism, because the truth of the matter is that our generation, so Lucy's generation, my generation, is this tiny little micro generation. And actually, I can even sort of include a good portion of Gen X in this. and that we were the first generation of women to be born into the spoils of the feminist movement. We were the first generation to have access to birth control. We were the first generation to have access to safe abortions, to be able to purchase a home in our own name, to the Title IX legislation, et cetera, et cetera. I can go on and on and on.
To be allowed to adopt a children.
Yes.
On our own if we wanted.
Correct. All of these things were what the feminist movement was fighting for. And by the time we were born, it was already in place. And yet, the culture hadn't quite caught up. I mean, it's and you know what? For all of human history, men did one thing and women didn't. And all of a sudden, the bottom dropped out of our culture. And we had to adapt as human beings. And I think what our experience was, and to a certain extent, young women today, what we're all experiencing is this massive cultural shift and the growing pains that come with it. And so my book is really about those growing pains. And part of the growing pains isn't just from men themselves. It's and having to adjust to women in the workforce and women taking over the spaces that they traditionally had as their own and they had to now behave themselves. It's not just that. It's also women themselves and figuring out, making choices that aren't just that aren't just choices of the heart, but are choices of the mind. And one of the characters in this novel, the painter Violet, her older cousin, who's more in the Gen X mode perhaps than Lucy is, she's a struggling artist, and she's floundering because she wants some of the security that a relationship brings, that a real job brings, that money brings, that love brings. And it's somewhat at war with some of her more ideological ideas and her feminist philosophy. And I think that that's a genuine struggle that a lot of women face.
I think it's a genuine struggle that we all face. And I think... it's partially because it's a conflation of the actual reality, right. that we conflate our being able to work with our roles.
Right.
You know, and it's pre, this takes place pre that conversation, which I still keep on having, there is no women's or man's work. And also it should all be valued. If it were valued, I don't care. There is a separation. If somebody makes more money and somebody stays home, somebody has to take care of the in-laws. Somebody has to remember birthdays. All of this stuff has to get done. I don't care who does it, just value it all.
Agreed.
That conversation hadn't taken place.
Correct. That is brand new. The thing that was happening at the time that she was coming of age and what she was observing in the older women around her was that in order to succeed, you had to behave in business like a man, and you had to the masculine energy in order to get to where you wanted to go, in order to break the glass ceiling, is to sort of take on a bit more of a masculine approach. And I certainly noticed that when I was working in sports, that sort of the women who succeeded in sports were the women who could hang. If you were sensitive, you didn't belong in that field. And that was sort of like the and that's part of, in some ways, part of, I think, the second wave movement, a second wave feminism. But what we hadn't discovered yet, because it was too early, women had only really started to make their way in the workforce, what we hadn't yet discovered yet really was the second shift, which was that yes, women now, I mean, my generation of women, our generation of women, everybody works. Very few women have the ability, partially because just financially, very few women have the ability to opt out even if they wanted to. But let's pretend that everything being equal, most women don't opt out anymore. Most women continue working. But the thing that we didn't know at that time yet was that you could still be working extremely long hours. You could even be the breadwinner, and you're still going to be the one to come home and do all of the housework. And nobody really knew that that was one of the things that there hadn't been as much adjustment made. And I do think, though, it has shifted among my friends. I do know that there is a significant, I think that boys are raised now, this generation of boys are raised by women who are trying to make sure that their sons don't expect for their lives to be catered to. But based on every statistic, every article that I've read, that is mostly not the case. And of course, a lot of that has to do with our, I mean, I really am not familiar with the way it is here in the UK, but in America, we're having massive discussions about childcare mm-hmm. and about the inability for women to be able to recover after pregnancy before they have to go back to work and all of this, and what kind of work is valued and everything that you're saying. But that conversation, you're right, I don't think that conversation had happened yet.
And Lucy is looking at models. She herself has sort of an unrequited pining for her best friend. She looks at models of love to Violet. She looks at her own parents. She looks at Percy's parents. She looks at her friend Alexis.
And pop culture.
Yes, and pop culture. And you know, she's not finding anything particularly satisfactory. Her experiences aren't particularly satisfactory. However, I would say this heroine, if anyone's going to find answers, that it is going to be Lucy. That she
oh,
is
I hope
going.
So.
She is going. We don't know at the end of the novel. I do have every expectation that if anyone knows how to navigate, it will be Lucy. But to bring it back to The Catcher in the Rye, I think the similarities are that, you know, the loneliness and disappointment seem to be what are required to come of age. Are those necessary ingredients for growing up?
I think that adolescence is really lonely. And I also think that we go through many adolescences. I mean, I don't think I've completely let go of some of my adolescent yearnings and longings. I hope never to, because I feel like then you really have sort of disassociated. I also think that the world really is disappointing. And that is the age when you learn that. And it comes down on you really hard. But I will say that as much as I remember feeling that way, oh my God, look at how much injustice is going on in the world. I remember feeling that so gravely when I was the age that Lucy is. I will say that I am now 39 and I have had significantly worse moments in my 30s than I did in my teens. When my strength and the fortitude and my belief in humanity has really been tested over the last few years. And that I hope I really do think that if you lose that, if that goes away, you lose touch with the soft human part of us. Who wants to lose that? But there are plenty of people who have, sadly.
That to me is a very interesting idea, because Lucy seems to have a glimmer and a foreknowledge of sort of how Percy, despite his idealistic, you know, he's totally into philosophy in a way that she knows that he will not maintain. She knows that the pull of privilege and expectation mm-hmm. will be too much for him. And I look at someone like Greta Thunberg, mm-hmm. and that idealism of youth, that anger of youth, where before your 30s and before you have, kind of when you have the luxury.
Yes, when you don't have to work.
The luxury of idealism and the energy for idealism, that creates change.
Yes.
And yet there is a necessary disappointment. We need that energy. And yet there is a necessary disappointment that comes with, I can't change the entire world.
Right. Well, first of all, let me just sort of rewind for just 1 second, because yes, I think she does see what might happen to Percy. It's a possible, we don't know for sure. It's a possible outcome for who Percy might wind up becoming. But I've always felt, once you put a thing out into the world, whether it's a book, it's a piece of art, it's no longer yours. However people interpret it, it becomes theirs. And, you know, that's like the beautiful part and also the terrifying part. But I've always thought of, though the book is written in the present tense, I've always thought of it as being written from a Lucy sometime in the future. And so whether she knows that's exactly what's going to happen to Percy, she is in some ways writing about her experiences as a young person with the knowledge of sort of what is to come in terms of the way that a mind develops and the way that a person develops. But, you know, no, Percy has a bit more of a nihilistic view. And actually, in some ways, so does Holden Caulfield. And whereas I see Lucy as being a significantly more humanistic character. And yes, I mean, the idealism, you never want to give up that idealism. But you also at some point have to at some point develop some kind of a shell, you know, but thank God for the young people like her and for the people in the United States, the Parkland kids. I mean, we really need young activists. And I feel strongly, and it's sort of touched on a bit in this book, that one of the deep, deep failures of Generation X is that we chose, instead of fighting and standing up for things and really, I think some of it had to do with the fact that we were very disillusioned by our parents. By our parents' activism, because we grew up alongside neoliberalism, and we saw that they were these incredible activists that fought for all these things, but the second they got some money, all that went out the window. And that's really what happened. They got really rich, and they sort of, just because of circumstance. And so we sort of grew up alongside that, and we became very disillusioned by the idea of activism. And instead of fighting for things that we really should have been fighting for, I think on the whole, we chose to just put out really angry music and complain and sort of stay within ourselves. I wonder if some people would take exception to that. I know that there were serious activists, particularly in the African-American community. But I think on the whole, as a generation, we were really kind of disengaged. And that was a great fault, because we should have been more engaged. And I think we're paying for it deeply now. And that's one of the things that the book, I think, in some ways, in a small way, reckons with.
Tell me about the process of reckoning. What do you set out for yourself as a writer to do? Because you set out, you really wanted to challenge yourself with the timing of that. And so how do you, that's a personal exploration. How do you wrestle with answering things, and it's you, and then, but it's mine as a reader. Tell me about that process a bit for you.
Well, you know, this is my first time. It's my first time writing a novel. So it's all sort of like, I'm not sure. I don't know if I can give a real answer in terms of my process. I feel like I have to have a few more novels under my belt. But I will say that the things that I'm most interested in are cultural things. I can read anything. I'm a voracious reader, and I read across all genres, and I love everything. But I don't think I'll ever write a family story set in a country cottage. It's just not something that I don't think I have that ear. I don't think that's particularly something that I'd be interested in writing. I think I always am going to want to take on big cultural things. And not that this was necessarily a big cultural, I didn't take on something big cultural thing in this book. It's a small story about a young woman, but I was interested in larger cultural questions about feminism and about the way that men and male-female relationships and friendships and the way that these things have changed over the course of my generation. So I was thinking about some of those big questions. But you know, I'm not entirely sure exactly where I'm going to go from here in terms of the process. It's all so brand new in some ways, but I'm glad I have this experience. It'll help with the next one, I think. Although I've heard that the second novel is the hardest, so I don't know.
It's only the next hardest.
Right, exactly. They're all hard from exactly. What I hear.
Exactly. And so you'll have something to compare with.
Right.
And lastly, tell us why The Falconer.
Okay. So this is kind of an interesting story, I think. So I had an idea that I really wanted to have. This was very early on in the novel, and I knew that I wanted to have a scene set in Central Park. I just felt like so much of my own youth took place just wandering through Central Park with my friends and having conversations. And I knew I wanted to have a scene, and I thought in my head, you know, how interesting might it be for her to sort of walk through Central Park and come across a statue that she could see herself in? Or something. This was just a thought experiment. I didn't know if that's necessarily what I wanted to write. So I decided to go for a stroll through Central Park, and I looked around, and I'm like, you know, none of these statues are really striking me. And beyond that, this is so weird, I'm not seeing any women. So a little Google search on Professor Google later, and I've come to find that there's really no female representation in Central Park. We have Alice from Alice in Wonderland, who's a little girl. We have, and a fictional character. We have Mother Goose, also a fictional character. We have Juliet outside the Delcourt Theater, in the arms of Romeo, like sort of leaning up, kissing Romeo. We have the angel at the top of the Bethesda fountain. And there's a young girl in the fountain in the secret garden, uptown. And there's another sort of fountain with a couple of like dancing women, around a fountain. So there is female representation, but there's not a real woman, not the way that there are so many real men. And, you know, I'd known about the Falconer statue. It's a beautiful statue. I've passed by it many times, but in this one particular walk, I saw it and I thought, I would love for her to have a statue like this. And then I thought, but they don't make statues like this of women, do they? It's either the statues of women are, and she says it in the book, and this was my own thoughts that I sort of was able to sort of filter through Lucy, which is that the statues that they make of women are either they're sort of like standing for liberty or justice, or they're being demure, or they're angels. There's never a statue of there's never a statue of a woman just an anonymous woman standing on a field, releasing a bird into the wind. And it's a really beautiful statue. And I think it's very American. Even though it was actually designed in Italy, it's a very American statue because it sort of captures the American desire to command and the reverence for and the desire to command nature. And that's sort of like the whole, that's what the Transcendentalists were about. The
pioneering spirit.
Yes. And that's what Central Park is really about too, in mm-hmm. some ways. It's really like such a quintessential Central Park statue. And I just thought, of course she would see herself in somebody like that. It just happens to be that it's a man. And so the book is named after the statue called The Falconer, and it's of a falconer he's standing on top of a pedestal atop a central rock formation, a Central Park rock formation, and he's releasing a bird into the wind. And so she says that she loves that statue. And later on in that chapter, I hope it comes off as a little bit of a joke, where I'm sort of poking a bit of fun at her, where she's sort of like loftily saying, I want to be that. And Percy sort of takes her down a peg and says, what are you talking about? You can't be a statue. You know, you're not going to be a falconer. That's ridiculous. You're going to have to go in and get a law degree. No one gets to be the falconer. So I'm sort of like poking fun at her naivete too. So that's where the title comes from.
Well, and hopefully I do feel though that however you have released Lucy, you are the falconer.
You have
released Lucy to us.
Oh, thank you. That's a high compliment. Thank you.
Thank you, Dana. Take care.
Thanks.
And for more fabulous falconing women, go to radiogorgeous.com.